Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Hey, everyone. It's Asten Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your American pastoral of music news and criticism. I'm your host, Joe Coscarelli.
A worried man with a worried mind. No one in front of me and nothing behind. There's a woman on my lap and she's drinking champagne. Got white skin, got assassin's eyes. I'm looking up into the sapphire tinted skies.
I'm here today with John Pareles, chief music critic at The New York Times.
Hey, Joe.
And Dwight Garner, book critic here at The New York Times.
It's good to be here, Joe.
And we're here with the big news of the day, which is that Bob Dylan is the Nobel Prize winner this year in literature. How shocked were you guys by this when we were woken early this morning by the breaking news alert from our fine newspaper?
Well, I was pretty surprised. I mean, I've always thought he should have one, but you never believe it's going to happen. What did you think, Dwight?
You know, I sort of bounced out of bed. It made me so happy. I think it was just, well, a simple twist of fate, wasn't it? But, you know, the political news has been so dire, and somehow this just felt like a fresh bit of wind.
A little ray of sunshine.
Yeah. Well, it's also an affirmation that America has contributed something, that America is not this hellhole of bad politics.
Right.
Exactly.
And it's been more than, what, 2 decades since an American has won this prize?
Yeah, since Toni Morrison.
Coming from the book world, from the world of literature, is this offensive to people? How much of a troll is this to award the literature prize to a songwriter?
You know, it's a mixed thing. Everyone in the publishing world kind of loves it. You know, people love Dylan. I think if there's any sadness about this, it's that often a new writer is floated up in the Nobel Prize award, and the backlist comes into publication, and a lot of books are sold, and it drives people to bookstores. In this case, Dylan has a terrific memoir, but you know, I don't think people are going to run to buy Tarantula, his famously unreadable 1966 novel.
Yes. Don't.
Yeah. And, you know, his lyrics are still in print, of course, but it's not a financial victory for the publishing world.
Right. So we've seen this argument a few different places today. I think, you know, there's a piece by Anna North here at the Times in the opinion pages. I think you mentioned off Mike, Stephen Metcalf at
Slate. Slate wrote a nice piece saying this was a mistake.
Right. And the idea being that, you know, books need to protect books and literature, you know, is having its own issues with commercial success as musicians are, and this is sort of the one opportunity that a light can be shined on one person to represent a genre. So how does, or not a genre but an art form, how does Dylan fit into that role in terms of as an ambassador for literature?
Well, I mean, you want quality as well as promotion. I mean, you do want the Nobel Prize to mean something, and to have a voice this important go unrecognized diminishes the Nobel, maybe. Maybe, you know, just 1 year you can have something that's not a boost for sales, but is actually a recognition of someone who has changed the way we all absorb words. I mean, is that too strong, Dwight? I mean,
I think
poets, you know, in the wake of Dylan, working poets have had to think about different ways of putting together an idea They've read Dylan. They've absorbed Dylan. They've fought back, maybe. I don't know. A lot of people do pop culture references and weird transitions and things that I see are out of Dylan. Maybe they're out of Rimbaud.
I agree. You know, year after year after year, we've had these often obscure Eastern European and other sorts of writers win the Nobel. And I have nothing against that. A lot of them have been terrific. But having had these awards fall like that year after year, and even most book critics scratch their heads and wondering who these writers are, this strikes me as sort of a blow for sanity, a blow for weirdness, a blow for words in general, because Dylan is so clearly a word man. I mean, you can talk about his music and his voice, but it's the words. You know, he's a word guy. And this strikes me as a victory for the language.
So I want to go back to this idea of Dylan as poet. I read this piece this morning that was floating around Twitter by Ellen Willis from 1967, and she was already saying that it's a truism among Dylan admirers that he's a poet using rock and roll. She's quoting Jack Newfield, and he's also saying, you know, that if Whitman were alive today, he would play an electric guitar. But then she's coming out and saying Dylan's poetry isn't so hot. She says poetry requires economy, coherence, and discrimination. And Dylan has perpetrated prolix verses, horrendous grammar, tangled phrases, silly metaphors, embarrassing cliches, muddled thought. Some classic Ellen Willis there.
Well, if I can be Hunter S. Thompson here, and the downside is, I mean, that was 67. That was his prolix phase.
Sure.
I mean, you go back to Desolation Row, that is not prolix. That is savage. That is just like, you know, that's the knife to the heart.
Yes.
That song. And if she was reacting to that, I think, you know, critics love to be contrarian.
Of course.
Dylan doesn't deserve this. You know, it's so go, Ellen. All of the grammatical criticism is correct, but what he got through words and what he told us about words, you know, the way you can just kind of hotwire your synapses by making a strange leap, you know, he just smoked my eyelid and punched my cigarette. I mean, that's better than grammar.
So she gets to this point, though. She says his chief literary virtue, Dylan's, is sensitivity to psychological nuance, and that belongs to fiction more than poetry. Dwight, is he a poet?
I mean, I think he has to be. It's funny, the first quote you read from Ellen Willis, I think I could agree with almost everything she said. All those put-downs are true. I mean, they're always true, in part about Dylan. You can always find songs that, at least if you put the lyrics on the page without music, would look a little bit half-baked, as I think Philip Larkin, the British poet, said once about one of Dylan's lyrics. And yet, you know, that's ignoring so much about why he mattered. Well, I'm sorry, what was the second part of her analysis?
She says that his chief literary virtue belongs more to fiction than to poetry.
I don't agree with that at all. I think he has this, I mean, he certainly has a great deal of psychological insight, especially on a record like Blood on the Tracks, or, I mean, just really probing in a Philip Roth almost sort of way, human relationships. But he had a gift just for chains of imagery as well, just sort of throwing down in an Allen Ginsberg sort of way.
And also there's psychological acuity in poetry too.
Yeah.
A little bit here and there.
Yeah.
So we often hear this debate about whether calling music, whether pop or rock or rap music, whether having to equate it with poetry does a disservice to, you know, either medium, to have to put it on this pedestal as something else to give it validity as art. Is that something that you see happening here with calling Dylan a Nobel Prize winner in literature?
Well, to me, I think it's kind of too late. The horse has left the barn or whatever. One of the great things about Dylan was that he overturned this high-low distinction. You know, literature is on the pedestal, rock and roll is in the gutter. No, rock and roll is in the sky with literature when Dylan does it. I don't think it's bad necessarily that Dylan's lyrics were made to go with songs either. I think that enforces a certain discipline because you have to be able to say them. They have to be oral. People still go to poetry readings, I've heard, right? I mean,
a few.
Because you want to hear what they sound like in a human voice.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are poets who read better on the page than they read on a podium. And Dylan has always had to make sure that he reads with a beat and with a guitar, and I don't think that's a bad discipline.
You know, poets are still smarting in a way from writers like Dylan. He stole rhyme from them. You know, if writers like Dylan came along and rhymed so beautifully that poets retreated, and now the most elite poetry doesn't rhyme at all. And the rock lyricists sort of won that battle or took that away from them in a way.
Well, actually, the hip-hop guys really, with the internal rhymes and the virtuosity there, they raise the stakes too.
Dwight, talk to us a little bit about Dylan's books. You know, obviously we have Chronicle from 2004, is it?
Yeah.
And then he has some prose poetry collection, Tarantula, which I think was written in the mid-60s but didn't come out officially until the early 70s. How do those stack up to his songs in your eyes?
Well, Chronicle was a great revelation in the sense that you found out this man could really write prose. I mean, he was a terrific prose writer. And the book, it sounds like him nonetheless. I mean, it's sort of interestingly all over the place. I mean, he's sharp cuts and odd observations and a very untraditional sort of memoir that I think is masterful. I mean, it's one of the great rock books, one of the great rock memoirs ever written, if not the best. We can debate that forever. But, you know, Tarantula was a one-off, a kind of crazy thing he threw together in 1966, and everyone ran out to buy it as a great cover. It looks cool. It looks weird. I remember first buying it when I was maybe 13, and you make it through about a page and a half, and then you realize this is not going to happen.
Do we think it's flying off the digital Amazon shelves today?
Might be flying off the bootleg digital shelves.
But, you know, but Chronicles was a remarkable book, and a lot of us really are holding our breath that there'll be a second volume to that.
Because it's called Volume 1,
exactly.
Right? But
that
could be the classic Dylan faint.
Let us not forget the Traveling Wilburys, Volume 1 and Volume 3. the thing about Chronicle, though, is it's so cagey. I mean, he is the classic unreliable narrator. He is a character from one of his songs in his book. I mean, it's Bob Dylan, but it's also Bob Dylan in quotes, and it's also Bob Dylan saying the word Bob Dylan in quotes. It's a great
it's
book just
true.
For that.
So, John, one of the things that you bring up in the piece that you wrote today in reaction to this is the question of sort of why now? Dylan hasn't put out much original music in the last few years. The book we just mentioned came out, you know, a decade ago. Why now?
I'm baffled myself. Could they? Was it a deadlock? Was like one of these like two like an Oscar nomination, like two actors from the same
split
movie?
Split the vote, and Dylan came out victorious.
I've heard nothing about the deliberations, but it strikes me as just, you know, we've had a lot of writers in recent years that people hadn't heard a lot about, and this strikes me as just, you know, a wild hair coming out of the Swedish Academy in a really fun way. I am a little. I think a lot of people are a little bit sad that Philip Roth hasn't won it yet. I mean, in my mind, there's no doubt that he deserves the Nobel Prize.
Well, and Don DeLillo, too,
and
right?
DeLillo as well. I personally would argue for Roth over DeLillo, at least if you only have one of them. You know, I hope that happens. I mean, Roth is not getting younger. Neither is Mr. Dylan.
So let's go ahead and listen to a little bit of Not Dark Yet by Bob Dylan.
Feel like my soul has turned into steam. I've still got the scars, not the sun and nail. There's not even room enough to be anywhere. It's not dark yet, but it's getting there.
So, John, you and I just came back from the California desert. We were at Desert Trip, a.k.a. Old Chella, this last weekend. And Dylan,
We saw Bob Dylan.
We did not know we were seeing a Nobel Prize winner in our midst. But he played the first set of the weekend about sundown on Friday evening. What did you make of that performance?
I thought it was one of the better sets I've seen by him. For one thing, the sound system was really good. There are always complaints about current Dylan that you can't understand his words, that he's mumbling. I can make them out really well. He was enunciating. His voice is
relatively still enunciating.
No, I mean, I thought it was pretty clear. But, I mean, I know these songs, so I may be hearing the lyrics I've seen in my head for a while. But I thought he was pretty crisp. His voice is a wreck. His voice is like the Colosseum in Rome. I mean, it's
present day.
Yeah, present day. You know, it's sort of remarkable to see, but there was a lot more of it at one point. And he uses that to be the nasty old man that he is in so many of his songs. What we just heard, Not Dark Yet, that's a song about mortality and about, you know, facing up to our limits and our eventual death. And he has the voice to sing about that stuff. He did a set mostly, except for a couple of benevolent songs, Make You Feel My Love, but he did a set of some of his like darkest, meanest, cruelest, saddest songs. He did Pay in Blood from Tempest. He did Ballad of a Thin Man, You Don't Know What's Happening, Do You, Mr. Jones? He did Desolation Row, and he really, to me, he sang them. You know, he does have a way of rattling off songs. There's a couple of tricks he uses. He did it in a couple of songs early in the set, and I thought, uh-oh, he's just spinning his wheels here. Then it got darker and darker and clearer, and he was snarling, and he was sarcastic, and he was cynical, and he was flippant, and he was funny, but mostly he was just cutting to the bone. And he's an improviser. Even if you listen to his records, he doesn't come back to the chorus the same time each way. He waits half a beat. He jumps on a different syllable. He's always improvising, and he was improvising that day, and he seemed to me very present in a way he isn't always when he's touring.
John, what's the first time you saw Dylan play?
Oh, boy. A long time ago, and I'm not sure I remember. I've seen a lot of Dylan. I've seen him at least since the 70s. I didn't see any of the. I'm not old enough to have come to Carnegie Hall to see him, or if I did, I would have been like a crying child.
Do you have specific memories of seeing him in the 70s?
Well, yeah. I mean, I saw Good Dylan and Bad Dylan. I saw the Rolling Thunder tour at Madison Square Garden, which was just this big banging thing with him in whiteface, and you know, just slamming through the songs and not interesting. I saw him with the band when they got back together, and that was better than the record they made. One of the great gigs I saw was Dylan at the Supper Club with the first iteration of his new band, the band that has been playing the Never Ending Tour ever since, with Tony Garnier on bass. And it was the whole different band, except for Tony Garnier, who's still in that band, at the core of that band. But it was just great to see him with musicians who really got him. And the band was like, it was a country band in one song, and it was a blues band in another song, and it was this string band from the backwoods in another song. It had everything, and he was working on what would be his 90s comeback. Suddenly those songs are alive again. You know, I've seen him good, I've seen him bad. You get the feeling with Dylan, though, that on stage, I mean, the Neverending Tour is the right name. It's like, okay, I'm good one night, I'm bad one night.
And you just keep going.
You just keep going, and you feel the chemistry of the moment, and you do what you can. I do think he doesn't have to do this. He could sit home and he's got 900,000 kronor now to count. But you know, he doesn't. He's not doing this because he needs the money. He's doing it because he wants to do it. I interviewed him once, and he said, "There's nothing about the road I don't like."
Wow.
Doesn't it depress you? I get depressed sometimes when I think of maybe the records we've lost because he's been touring all the time. Maybe he's so prolific that he's doing as much as he would have done ordinarily. But I kind of miss the songs he might have written instead of playing 250 nights a year or 300.
Huh, I don't know. I mean, maybe he's blocked. I mean, because he hasn't, or maybe they haven't reached his quality control standards.
And so the set we saw this weekend was different than the set he's been playing the last few years, which has relied more on pop standards and things like that. Do you think he was conceding a little bit to the atmosphere, which was, you know, sort of this celebration of 60s and early 70s acts, and it was a little bit of a nostalgia trip for people? Like, was he giving in ever so slightly to that, but then throwing the barbed wire on it with the set list choice?
The great thing about Dylan is that we're still asking the question. We don't know. We're in the audience with everybody else asking the same question. Is he teasing us? Is he baiting us? I don't think he plays that much to nostalgia, though. I mean, he knows he's got good songs. He knows those old songs are just amazing. There were three or four songs from Tempest from 2012, so he's not doing my oldies set. And even when he does the old songs, he's thinking them differently. You feel them differently. I mean, Desolation Row, when he did it in 1966, is different from Desolation Row now because it's got all those years in it and it's got all that accumulated weight in it. I hear them differently, and I mean, it's obviously I'm a fan. I don't know if you noticed. I hear those songs as someone continually trying to find out what's new in them. I don't hear him doing anything by rote if he can help it.
And now sometimes that turns people off, because one of the things, you know, that you can notice at Desert Trip, and I think you see a lot or you hear a lot when Dylan is touring, is, you know, people are dismayed by these arrangements they don't recognize, or the quality of his voice, or the song choice. And you know, there was some disrespect on the floor, I would say, at Desert Trip, of people talking through the set or not paying attention. And, you know, he's putting on a different show than the Stones or Paul McCartney. But it's nice then to see with this Nobel Prize that we are appreciating him while he's here. And yeah, and it's not only the, you know, why don't I just get the hits the way that I knew them when I was younger?
Yeah, I mean, I was at a Beacon Theater show where somebody was screaming "Lay, Lady, Lay" through the whole thing. And it's like, okay, we get your point, you know, but he wasn't about to do it. I mean, he's actually been changing his set list since June. There have been a lot of, he did the same set for like a year and a half or 2 years, pretty much, which I saw at the Beacon and I saw at the Royal Albert Hall. I'm not a fan, really, obviously. But, I mean, he did that same set for a while, and he started changing it this summer. But for him to do the same set was the aberration. That was the head-scratcher for me, not to go back and do this set of old stuff and new stuff that's still the meanest, cynical, toughest-minded, smartest guy you'll ever see.
What's the best Dylan biography?
The one that comes to mind immediately is Clinton Hale, and it's really well-researched.
How old is that book?
You got me.
Is it fairly recent, or is it 80s?
No, it's fairly recent.
Okay.
And Halen has also been doing a lot of the liner notes for the reissues. You know he's going to be accurate.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you guys, you know, up to this point, you know, we're recording this on Thursday afternoon. Dylan hasn't said anything about winning this award. We don't know if he cares or not. He's busy doing iron work lately, I think, in addition to prepping for the second
Bill
weekend
Clinton
of Desert
Trip. Tweeted an iron sculpture that he did for him. Who knew?
Dylan's great. Been quietly honing his iron working in addition to
his irony.
This set. His irony, yes. But so in addition to obviously Bob Dylan, who we don't know if he cares about this award or not, but it's a big win for Dylanologists and Dylan fans everywhere, I think, sort of feel victorious in some way on his behalf. But like, who are some of the people who helped to rise Dylan's work to this level where it could be considered for a Nobel Prize? Are there, you know, you mentioned the biographers, but are there other sort of critics and academics that have been crucial in studying this work?
Well, I'll take one stab, John, then I'm sure you'll have other books. But Greil Marcus has written two terrific books about Dylan. One's just a collection of Greil's various pieces about Dylan, and I can't remember the title. But then there's The Old Weird America about Dylan and the band's basement tapes. And both of those books are just, I think, first rate. There's also the venerated British academic and critic Christopher Ricks has a book analyzing Dylan's lyrics as poetry. It's called Dylan's Visions of Sin, and it's a lot of fun, and it's very thoughtful. It compares Dylan to Tennyson and Keats, and it's a marvelous book.
Well, also, Dylan, the comparisons aren't outlandish. I mean, Dylan is steeped in those guys. Dylan comes out of that very elaborate rhyme schemes and the you know, thinking about metaphors, thinking about images, looking at yourself in nature. But there is a whole academic cottage industry of Dylanology. I mean, I'm sure there's Dylan courses in graduate schools nationwide, are there not?
Without a doubt, yes.
They're justified. But just being the music guy, I got to say, it ain't just the words. Ellen Willis is right about that. Lots of people are right about that. It is. You do get that extra kick from the fact that this song is a blues. This song has a quivering, weird guitar line. This song is like dirgy piano chords. This song is a carnival. That's another dimension to the poetry. I mean, it's not strictly on the page, and maybe it's Dylan's secret weapon. The Nobel people may not care about that, but I really do.
I do, too. Can I read you two sentences of Christopher Ricks?
Oh, yeah.
This is from Dylan's Visions of Sin. Christopher Ricks writes, "Dylan's is an art in which sins are laid bare and resisted, virtues are valued and manifested, and the graces brought home." He adds, "Human dealings of every kind are his for the artistic seizing," which, you know, the whole book is filled with observations like that.
given what we know about Dylan and how he feels about this sort of pomp and circumstance, what are you guys expecting out of his acceptance speech or whatever it may be?
He tends to give good speeches, doesn't he, John?
Well, he gave this great speech at the Recording Academy. He was Person of the Year, and you expected him to come out and talk for, you know, 10 minutes and mumble something. And he came out for 45 minutes and denounced all the people who said he had a bad voice.
Settled some scores.
But
all haggard, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, he said nobody ever complains about Tom Waits' voice, of course.
Which is not true.
The internet lit up with, oh, yes, they do. But also he talked about, which he also actually said to me in an interview in the 90s was, you know, folk music is my Bible and my lexicon to me. And he said, you know, if you listen to John Henry enough, of course you're going to write that lyric about the railroad. And no, you're not if you're not Bob Dylan. I mean, but that's the genius in the guy. I think you can't overestimate what folk songs and Hank Williams and Woody Guthrie and Carter Family and all these things meant to him, the blues. I mean, the crazy non sequiturs in his lyrics that are so great and surreal and, you know, parallel to Rambo are also old blues guys. One part of Dylan's genius was to see that connection and to make it. And I think it's kind of like short-circuiting two hot wires. You know, the car suddenly leaps into motion because you've ignited this thing that wasn't connected before.
And yeah, do you see this prize as sort of, you know, an acknowledgement of all of those, that folk history that you're saying, in addition to, you know, the Beats and whoever else?
I think it would be nice. I don't know. I mean, we are in the – I mean, I do think Dylan helped the great postmodernist collapse of high versus low. It would be nice if the Nobel recognized the folk tradition. You can't really hand it to anybody. And Anonymous, as far as I know, is dead.
But to be the man who took folk songs, as you said, and hitched them to rock and roll, I mean, that was a huge moment. And it just brought those folk songs alive. And the new ones he wrote held up next to the old ones.
But he hitched them to Rambo, and he hitched them to Whitman, and he hitched them to Shakespeare, and he hitched them to...
Before he hitched them to rock and roll.
Yeah.
So I have to do this. Dwight, some favorite Dylan lyrics? You don't have to pick one,
man.
But...
You know, it's funny. I think of It's Done with the Flick of the Wrist all the time. It's not a favorite. It's not one of his great moments, but it's one of those things that I think, what is the song where he says, "Is there a hole around here for me to get sick in?" What is that song?
I can't place it.
I love Blind Willie McTell.
The ghost of electricity howls in the bones of her face. His descriptions of women are just astonishing to me. My love is like the window, like a raven with a broken wing. He can be so romantic.
And so the opposite.
And so the opposite.
Idiot wind.
So cruel.
You're an idiot, babe. It's a wonder you still know how to breathe.
A classic. Let's go out with that.
Dedicated to the Nobel Committee?
Yeah. We're going to hear a little bit of Idiot Wind by Bob Dylan.
Fantastic.
Thank you for listening. You can read John Pareles and Dwight Garner on Bob Dylan at nytimes.com/music. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. You can email us at podcast@nytimes.com if you have favorite Dylan lyrics, anything of the sort. Listen to us wherever podcasts are sold and downloadable. Our producers are Jocelyn Gonzalez and Pedro Rosado, and we'll be back next week.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
Hey, listen. Remember how you told me to toss those takeout containers before we left for vacation? And you were like, I'm serious. If that leaks over the counter, it'll be a slimy abomination by the time I get back. And I was like, yeah. Of course. Don't worry about it. I won't forget. Well.
Ooh, yeah. That happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed. Rinse after use if in contact with food surface.